Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This year's legislative session ended last week, and it's always interesting to compare what lawmakers have in mind in those early days to what they actually get done by the end. If you're a conservative culture warrior, going into the session, you had an impressively ambitious list. There were bills targeting undocumented immigrants. There was a bill to erase transgender rights from state law. Students required to watch anti-abortion videos in school health classes. But what actually happened this year, for whatever reason, was that those kinds of bills didn't make it. Lawmakers had less patience with the flashy rhetorical stuff. Our colleagues in the newsroom described the session as more like an admin day, with the energy focused on technical government business rather than big culture war fights. It could have been sensitivity to the midterms. It could have been fatigue with Donald Trump. But as the political consultants Jackie Morgan and Gabby Finlayson told us, sometimes extreme ideas just run up against the basic process of shepherding a bill through the system. It's what they call the small p politics. And the perfect example of that this year was the Republican representative from Layton, Trevor Lee.
He's one of the newer representatives, and he has made quite the name for himself. You know, online he's used slurs. He is someone who is very honest about being xenophobic, homophobic, transphobic, anti-woman, anti-immigrant. So people were very nervous about what he would do and curious to see how it would go for him.
He started session coming out of the gates swinging with his bill on Harvey Milk Boulevard, changing that to Charlie Kirk Boulevard. That bill didn't go anywhere. But he started session with that message, and he continued it throughout session with the rest of his bills.
And I think that's been bad for him because Trevor Lee has had a tough go this year. He's run bills that would ban social-emotional learning, bills that would make ivermectin a standing order at all pharmacies, vaccine exemptions, bills that have to do with the fertility crisis in a very odd way. And every single one of these bills has been a catastrophic failure.
That because of Trevor Lee's personal politics, his relationships, and most legislators, they care a lot about the policy and they care a lot about getting things done, but they also care about the process. And he has been unable to do that at every step. So his big sweeping legislation that Trevor Lee ran this year was HB 88.
The main motivation for this was to strip existing exemptions from Utah's immigration verification requirements, meaning that any sort of public assistance programs that are currently exempted from those agencies having to check someone's immigration status, those all would be removed. So every single public assistance program would be taken away from any undocumented people.
These would be services like immunizations, food banks, crisis counseling, homeless shelters, domestic violence shelters, CHIP healthcare, WIC for children, and communicable disease testing.
And on top of that, it also gave any taxpaying Utah citizen the private right of action, meaning if one undocumented person received even a dollar in public assistance, any taxpayer could sue the state over that for damages.
It was a very sweeping piece of legislation. But they did circle that bill, which means they put the bill on pause. And I think Representative Lee knew that when that bill went on pause, that it wasn't ever coming back. It was pretty much dead. And then he found a workaround.
Second substitute on HB 386 under Representative Lee's name. Would you like to speak to that, Representative Lee?
Yes, I would, just briefly.
The rule that we always joke, like the number one rule of the Utah legislature, is that no bill is ever dead. And so HB 88 came back in someone else's bill. There is another immigration-related bill. And on the floor, Representative Lee stood up and made a substitute.
a seventh version of his HB 88 into this new bill.
It restricted in-state tuition for undocumented high school students, state retirement benefits, housing loans, professional licensing, and scholarships for high school graduates here in Utah.
And that led to some very powerful testimony on both sides.
Thank you, Mrs. Speaker. I'm going to take a moment here because this is important.
In particular, we had Representative Hong Nguyen stand up. She is the first Vietnamese American and the first refugee ever elected to the Utah legislature.
My family and I, we came from Vietnam. We came after the Vietnam War. My mom and dad, seven kids, we first came to the Bay Area, Oakland, California.
She is someone who benefited directly from these programs that they are trying to cut. You know, she is someone who was able to stay in this state and start a business and employ thousands of Utahns. Like, she is a real example of why this matters. And she is standing up in the chamber, sharing her story where they are trying to end those programs.
By subbing in these substitutes, I would not have been able to go to college. My mother would not have been able to buy that house on the west side and be able to leverage it to build the first restaurant that she had. I fear that what we're doing here in Utah is we are eroding what truly makes Utah special, the Utah way. We are starting to adopt policies that are regressive and don't take care of people. Utahns are one thing. Citizens are one thing. People is the first thing.
They still took the vote. It passed 39-33, which is a very narrow vote in the Utah House. But when it passed the House floor, it didn't have a Senate sponsor.
And amazingly, no senator will sponsor this bill.
Because of the toxicity of both Trevor Lee's politics and the message of this bill, not a single senator wanted to put their name on it. And it got stuck in the limbo between the House and the Senate, and it's going to die there.
You know, I think sometimes your personal political brand is more toxic than the legislation you're trying to run somehow. And even with Representative Trevor Lee, who is running some of the worst legislation, the reason that his bills are not passing, it's partially because there are people that don't support it, but it's also partially because no one wants to be associated with his brand of politics.
His irresponsibility or lack of compassion throughout the rest of this process, it didn't win at the end of the day, and I hope it doesn't work in years in the future.
That's Jackie Morgan and Gabby Finlayson. They're senior partners at Elevate Strategies. It's a Democratic political consulting firm. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this year's legislative session, which included a $31 billion budget, another income tax cut, major changes in the court system, discussions about homelessness and housing policy and water and land. We have with us for the hour Robert Gerke. He's a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have Holly Richardson. She's the editor of Utah Policy. And we have our own politics reporter here at KUER, Sean Higgins. And we began with a comparison between what they thought would happen with the session compared to what actually did. And Sean Higgins got us started.
Going into the session, what I thought might happen was a complete demolition of the judicial system in Utah. Looking at some of the bills that were proposed going into the session, it would have been unrecognizable. We would have had a 60% threshold to retain a judge. We would have had essentially snap retention elections for any judge who did something. It was called certain conduct in the bill, yeah. But it was basically anything the legislature didn't like. They could call a snap retention election for a judge. And talking with people in the legal field, that made some people incredibly scared about this, just the independence of the courts, the ability for judges to do their job without fear or favor. That is just a tenet of a pillar of the judicial system in the United States. And I think looking at some of the bills that were proposed that specifically had to do with judges was pretty alarming. And none of that really happened except for one or two little things.
And I think that is the theme throughout, right? Going in, it wasn't just courts. Like, there were a lot of really harsh immigration bills. There were really harsh election or drastic changes to the elections process.
Yeah.
And sort of, these were all kind of lining up to be like, oh, this is going to be a really sort of bitter, nasty session, I think, and a lot of fighting that was going to be happening, and some of it happened, but sort of the most draconian bills in each of those areas, I think, ended up getting shelved along the way.
Holly, what did you see?
I was looking at immigration bills and election bills, and they weren't as bad as they could have been at the end of the day. But that's what I was most worried about. Yeah.
Okay. So you had your expectations and they didn't map out. And we'll talk about in the ways they did and didn't. But
we hope for the best and prepared for the worst.
Right.
and I think it didn't pan out that way because a couple reasons. I mean, the Senate seemed to be tamping down a lot of the more radical House bills.
I would say the Senate was more willing to do that this year than the last handful of years. At least speaking, hearing during media time, when you'd mention a House bill, there was kind of this group eye roll when we'd mention House bills to them. And sometimes there were some friendly little jokes here and there about what the House does, but I would say for sure the Senate was more tempering this year.
And sometimes I think the House sponsors didn't do their homework on their bills, and so you ended up or they weren't communicating with their Senate colleagues. The election bill is a good example of it. Representative Jefferson Burton had the big get rid of vote by mail. Everybody would have to bring their ballot back to the drop box or back to the voting booth, and you know, it was like there were 3 days left, 4 days left or something like that. They hadn't had any the discussions that they needed to have with the Senate sponsor. And so they said, well, we'll do a study, but we're not going to make this huge plunge in reforming the way we do our elections, which was going to cost $7 million for the county clerks to operate these drop boxes without knowing how we're going to do it and having answers to questions about how it impacts rural voters in particular. And so, you know, it was just sort of sometimes the ideas weren't fully baked when they got floated out there.
It gets us to something that we had been hearing, and that was how personality was getting in the way of actually passing bills. And there was this tweet, Robert Gerke, you pointed out in one of your pieces that you pointed out to us that came from Senator Dan McKay, who said, and he was getting at Representative Trevor Lee. That seemed clear, right? Mm-hmm. He said, the secret of getting bills passed is one, people, two, process, three, policy. And you have to have all three. And in respect to Representative Trevor Lee, he said maybe the policy's there, maybe the process might sort of be there, but the people part wasn't there. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about – because that seems like a pushback from the Senate to the House, right? That seems like a pushback from – I don't know if you could describe it as somebody who's more ideologically moderate, sort of pushing back on someone who's – more extreme, but what do you make of that as an idea?
Well, first of all, Dan McKay is not ideologically moderate. He's not. He's very conservative. But
which is even more interesting.
Yeah. So I remember during my time in the legislature and even leading up to that, the numbers that people told us, it's 35, 15, and 1. You have to get 50% in the House, 50% in the Senate, and you have to have the governor sign. So if you can't work with people, and this is something that I have seen in the 25 years I've been following Utah politics, there are always some elected officials who think that it's just their idea and they don't have to work with anybody. It's a really interesting phenomenon because they're like, they will read the bill, they'll know it's good, and people will vote for it. And it just doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. So to Senator McKay's point, you have to at least bring along half of your colleagues.
So outside of them being just driven by personalities, why has there been some more pushback this year? It's an election year. People are thinking about the midterms. The idea of affordability comes up, which is interesting. So how much of – can you sense that the influence of Donald Trump is maybe diminishing a little bit, or the sort of more moderate sensibility is taking – are you sensing any of that playing out at the legislature?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a diminishment of Donald Trump, because in some issues he was a very outsized presence, AI in the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah,
in
particular, we'll come back to that.
Yep. I'm sure we'll come back to. But I think this push for affordability is something that has touched everyone, whether it's through the tariffs or the labor market being pretty stagnant right now. Like, everything, almost every Utahn, unless you are in the top tiers of wealth, is really – you either are affected directly or someone you love is being affected directly by one of these factors. So I think there was way less of an appetite for some of these clickbaity topics when you had literally everyone talking about the price of groceries – and rent and how you can't afford down payment and interest rates are still so high, there's nowhere to live. And to the point about you have to have people policy and what was the third
process,
one?
Process and policy.
People process and policy. Yeah. Like the policy, yeah, like sure. There's a lot of people in the state of Utah who might think undocumented immigrants shouldn't have public benefits, but do you have the process and the people to get that across the line? Like this wasn't the year for that type of stuff.
I think politically and electorally, heading into the midterm elections, it's not necessarily beneficial to be running with the president, because I think we've seen in all of the elections leading up to the midterms, he's a liability now, not an asset. And so I don't think there's people were stampeding to cozy up to President Trump, even though, you know, he won this state. I think maybe keep a distance a little bit. I don't know how much that shaped the influence the policy, but I think going to what Sean said, affordability is the buzzword for this election. And so I think to the extent that they were able to lean in that direction and maybe away from some of the MAGA tendencies that otherwise might have prevailed, I think that played a role. I can't say that was the sole reason.
It was quiet up there this year. It felt like we called it an admin day at the office, basically, for most of the session. They were just kind of doing their business, doing their thing. We'll talk a little bit about courts. That was like some of the fieriest stuff was around the court stuff. Some intervention from the White House on a few issues. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was just kind of a shrug a little bit as far as like newsy, like, oh, we're going to get some headlines out of this.
I wish that more sessions were like that, to be honest.
Governor loved it. He said he didn't have any vetoes, at least in mind.
He got what he wanted out of the budget.
I would say, that the legislature this year, they were going after judiciary and not the executive branch. So that was a positive, right? They were going after the LG for sure. But as far as like restraining executive power, there wasn't really that.
Yeah, there wasn't really that. And they did go after the court. I think if they had gone more hardcore on the courts, we would have heard a lot more from the governor, because the governor has been very outspoken about his affinity for the judicial branch and how they deserve to be truly a co-equal branch of government. In the past, like I'm thinking in past years when the idea of electing our judges has been floated, he's like, hard no on that. I will protect our judiciary on that. And he wasn't really put in a tough political spot with any of the bills that were passed this year, at least in my interpretation of things that happened, where he had been in the past.
There was an issue where he was in line. The governor was certainly aligned with at least Republican lawmakers, most Republican lawmakers, and this was this last-minute change to an election bill that would make it more difficult for voters to remove their names from that petition to repeal Utah's ban on partisan gerrymandering. Robert Gerke, tell people what happened. This was 11th hour.
Yeah, literally the 11th hour. So hour left in the – there was a bill to regulate how signatures get removed from petitions. And this goes to the Republican-backed effort to repeal Proposition 4, which banned partisan gerrymandering. Right now, they've got the signatures. There had been this campaign to try to get people to remove them. Better Boundaries had been sending these forms to people with a pre-stamped envelope or a prepaid envelope so people could easily mail it back to their county clerks. After 11 o'clock on the last night, Senator Brady Brammer put an amendment on the bill that says county clerks cannot accept those prepaid envelopes after the date of the enactment of the bill. It passed quickly, and the governor signed it within hours of it passing the legislature.
Holly, so, did you say he didn't even go home, the governor?
I don't think he – what I heard was he was still there at 2 o'clock in the morning signing that bill.
Yeah. So it's in effect now. All of those envelopes that were sent out, you know, the thousands of dollars they spent sending those envelopes out and paying the postage on them are now worthless, I guess. And the Better Boundaries said, you know, this just shows how, you know, people in power can change the rules in the middle of the game to deprive citizens their voice. And it does seem like it's changing the rules in the middle of the game.
Yeah.
I don't think – I asked the governor to his office to comment on that, and they opted not to. but it's kind of – you know. Is it going to matter in the long run with that initiative? Probably not. They seem to have it fairly safe, fairly comfortable cushions in the Senate districts they need. But it's – I don't know if it's a good look to be, you know, to be doing that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in that same ballpark, it didn't come up this session, but we got a strong indication that we will be seeing a special session to get another constitutional amendment on the ballot mm-hmm. for 2026 to define what alter and reform means and whether citizens really do have the right to alter and reform their government via initiative or referendum. So yeah, expect more on that.
They really want to clarify their authority to repeal or amend citizen-passed initiatives. And you know, they tried it before. The Supreme Court knocked it off the ballot because they said the ballot language was deceptive. There was talk about it the entire session, and we were all just waiting for the language to come out, and then it didn't. So, you know, I think to Sean's point, I think there is some acknowledgement that there might be a special session this year to try to.
Well, doesn't it seem like there has to be a special session if they're going to try to derail? Or have they conceded that an election is going to happen given with these new maps?
I would say, barring something unforeseen, we're going to have the map we have now in 2026. But all of these dominoes are being lined up for if it all goes their way in November that. 28, we're going to be back to some version of what we've been used to for the last handful of years as far as maps.
Yeah, I think that sets up an interesting thing too, right, is finally have some certainty on the maps, which is not the Utah legislature specifically, although they're sure trying to weigh in on that. But the legislative session ended on Friday, and they're opening filing for congressional candidates. It'll last a week, and next week is caucuses. March 17th. So it's that's a really short time frame for at least some candidates. But it'll be interesting. I think 2026, we have the maps for 26. I think 28 could be different. I think 30 could be different. I think 32 will definitely be different. Mm-hmm. So stay tuned for that.
Holly Richardson, she's the editor for Utah Policy, along with Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune and KUER's Sean Higgins. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're getting some final thoughts on this year's legislative session. Most observers say the session was unexpected. If you look at the array of bills introduced in those early days, what actually happened was more muted than people thought, so less flash and culture war rhetoric. No big themes stood out, though lawmakers did make some important changes to Utah's courts. So we're talking about this more sedate session with Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, Holly Richardson, and our own Sean Higgins. Well, let's talk about the money for a minute. The budget, they passed a $31 billion budget. What does that tell us? Sounds like the revenues were decent this year for the state.
Yeah, the budget conversation, I think going into this session, we were expecting to see a lot of slashing.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature made all the state agencies go through a budget cutting exercise, like find 5% and show us. We were full on expecting a lot of cuts, and then we get revenue estimates that are updated, and things looked a lot rosier than what we were expecting. Surprise, surprise, we have enough money for another income tax cut.
Sixth straight
year for income tax cuts. It was one of those things where I haven't gone line through the budget, but it did not seem to be as tight as was advertised.
Every year I've been up there, I think we go through this sort of song and dance where it's like, oh, the sky is falling. We're never going to have enough money. This year it seemed a little bit more pressing, I think, because there was the Trump tax bill that ended up costing the state about, I think it was $500 million over 2 years. And it was going to make things a little bit tighter. So they have to go through this, you know, exercise, this painful exercise of, oh, come to us with 5% cuts and, you know, then we'll reallocate it and we'll see what we can do. And then it always comes in and things look better. And then they also have this extra money that they can spend on the things that they want to pay for. And so, yeah, the tax cut is, I don't know. I mean, like you said, again, is Stuart Adams' famous line. You know, he wants to cut taxes every session. I'm not sure that it's going to have a profound impact on the affordability, that issue coming back to that buzzword, affordability. There was implementation of a child tax credit, which is going to be, I think, significant for a number of families. I think it totals about $10 million, so not huge from the statewide standpoint, but it could help some families with that affordability thing. So that's kind of where they ended up on tax issues.
I would say one thing that was interesting to me, though, is they did not end up doing the property tax shift that they had talked about at the beginning of the session. Mm-hmm. That was one where it just didn't go anywhere.
There were a ton of bills about property taxes because that's what, again, going into an election year, that's what these people are hearing from their constituents. And the state's hands are tied a little bit because the state doesn't really have much influence on the property tax. It's all connected at local counties, school districts, mosquito abatement districts, things like that. But they were under quite a bit of pressure to try to do something about that. And there wasn't much done. I mean, there was some transparency pieces to it. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of about the extent of it.
Let me shift to courts. Sean, you mentioned you were all sort of bracing for something really big. What actually did happen? What did they actually change?
Two bills, well, two and a half, I would say, bills in particular. We'll get to that in a second.
Are you talking about the three-judge panel thing?
The three-judge panel that has an addendum to
right.
it at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first big one was the one that everyone was really looking at, was expanding the Utah Supreme Court to 7 justices. And this was coupled with expanding parts of the lower courts, which was direly needed across the board. I think everyone in the judicial community was very happy to see at least some expanded resources at the lower
court level,
which they did. There was another bill by Senator Wyler that would have expanded the lower courts even more, but this was introduced before the Supreme Court thing. So I think a lot of that was rolled into this Supreme Court expansion bill. But the Supreme Court expansion bill adds 2 justices plus court staff. I'm forgetting the fiscal note on that, but it's not cheap to run the courts here in Utah. That was the big one. And it was noteworthy because the Supreme Court was not asking for this. We had Chief Justice Matthew Durant say, there is no backlog of which you speak in my court, but everyone else in the judicial system really needs some help. So help them, please.
But will you just help people understand, if you're a Republican lawmaker who is angered by what you see as an activist judicial branch, what does it get you to give 2 more justices to the Supreme Court if you have Republicans who are appointing these people in the first place? Like, what does that get you?
That's the big question, because when you look at this, if you are, say you are someone who is very supportive of this new map we have, or blocking the trigger law on abortion, you're seeing this through a partisan lens of, oh, they want more voices that could potentially side with them. to the point of, like, I think, Robert, you asked the governor this in a press conference, monthly news conference in November, I believe, like, mm-hmm. is this court packing? He said, how can it be court packing when every judge in the state of Utah is appointed and confirmed by Republicans?
Yeah.
And I think there's some truth to that. But I do think some of it is a little bit of an optics thing to show that they're trying to do something. And there's no guarantee.
Are you just increasing your chances
I guess
you'll get someone a little bit more
conservative? Yeah, maybe. And I think...
I don't know. What do you, Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, sorry. It's a murky one for me.
I mean, keep in mind the Republicans in the legislature passed in a resolution in December during a special session condemning the court for judicial activism in the redistricting case. They don't like the five justices that ruled against them on these issues. I think they see them as overstepping their judicial authority. In fact, they have said that. They have frankly just flat out said that they are activist judges overstepping their judicial authority, those five that were on there. One of them's retired. They replaced him with John Nielsen, who was Justice Lee's law partner. So he's kind of cut from the Tom Lee, Mike Lee cloth. He's much more conservative than I think than the others who are up there. So you can't think of this as do we have a Democratic court that we're changing to a Republican court? It's more about ideological purity, right? And so you can wait for the other four to be replaced and get the change you want on the court that way, or you can expand the court by two, and now you've got three of the four justices who are from that ideologically pure point of view. Mm-hmm. And then Justice Durant's going to be retiring soon. He's said as much. And now you've completely overhauled the court in just a couple – in short order.
Yeah.
The argument that Senator Wilson was making about this – we need this to expedite hearings or expedite rulings from the court. You know, as Sean said, the Chief Justice said we don't have a backlog. In fact, they are the rate of increase in the Supreme Court's filings. They had 17 more filings in 2025 than they did in 2008, I believe. And so, you know, it's not like it's not a rampage. The other courts are much more oversaturated than the Supreme Court was. But, you know, even Glenn Beck went on a tirade about this, saying that this is court packing and it's a threat to the survival of the republic when you start doing this, because now if Democrats get control, they're going to pack the court and you have no, you know, rational argument on which to stand. Now, yes, the Republican governor will appoint these justices. They'll go through the same screening process and be confirmed by the same Republican senators that have, confirmed every justice up to this point. But it can't be avoided that there is this displeasure that we haven't expanded the court in over 100 years, but we're doing it right now because it's crucial. And I think it's it's that and the constitutional court that Sean was talking about is why people like the state bar are saying that this is a threat to judicial independence.
Well, say something about that constitutional court thing. This is this three-judge panel. That seems like the most – I suppose if you're in the bar or you're concerned about the separation of powers, that this is the one that you're going to pay a lot of attention to. You want to talk a little bit about this particular part, this judge panel?
And sure. So this bill started out as creating an entirely new court called the Constitutional Court, which had been similar to like juvenile court, business and chancellery court, like the only deals in matters of constitutionality in Utah.
I thought that was the Supreme Court's job.
Well, that was one of the arguments that was made in this committee hearing. And I think we heard it was retired judges, retired or sitting law professors, retired law professors who were just pointing out how odd of a thing this would be in the fabric of American, not just Utah law, but like American law, like how weird this is, because we already have a mechanism to rule on constitutionality, and that would be the state Supreme Courts and the American Supreme Court. And eventually there was also a little bit of some concerns raised over how if these three judges were picked, the legislature would be handpicking the judges to specifically rule on the laws that they themselves were passing. So a little bit of I guess conflict of interest there in some respects. That got amended through the process to make it a rotating panel of three judges that are picked from existing district court benches. And then those were immediately challenged in court by under constitutionality by plaintiffs in redistricting, plaintiffs in the abortion cases we've seen. I think there are four ultimately who challenged this. And in response to that, the legislature amended another court bill to essentially write another trigger law that if the panel is struck down, then they're just going to go back to and create a new court like they originally planned. So this one is very much, I am not a lawyer. I don't have legal training. Some of this I'm really starting to rack my head around myself. But from what I'm hearing, this is the one that really changes the way law works in Utah.
I want to talk about one bill that got drafted but didn't get heard. It was late in the session, and I think it's HB 600, so you know how late it was. And
This one
would have allowed citizens to use an initiative process to overturn Supreme Court decisions, which on its face, and I'm not an attorney, sounds pretty unconstitutional to me.
You mean just taking the judiciary out of the decision-making process regarding constitutional
law? Ultimate will of the people. You talk about direct democracy, run wild.
We don't like that Supreme Court decision.
How far did that go?
Nothing. It got drafted.
It got drafted and didn't go anywhere.
One other change before we move on from courts was that there was a transparency bill that Speaker Schultz was really adamant about. So now judicial proceedings will be recorded and made it be easier for the public to access it. It'll be easier to access case files without having to pay for them, create an account and pay for them. And judges are going to have to issue or file financial disclosures, to kind of put them on par with the legislature. There was one provision in there that was kind of problematic, and that would have said that law firms that have sued or are contemplating litigation against the state cannot hire a judge for 2 years. It was a 2-year cooling off period, but it was imposed on the law firms. They ended up stripping that part out because that was probably unconstitutional as well. So that's part of what Speaker Schultz has said he wanted to do with the courts is make the, he said they're the least transparent branch of government. So he wanted to add some transparency there. They also passed a resolution condemning and censuring a judge down in Moab for a case, or his handling of a case involving child sex abuse material that has been a bee in Speaker Schultz's bonnet for quite some time. And that, again, passed, I believe, unanimously in the House. And
only in the House, though.
It was only a House resolution.
That's right.
And another issue that the Senate did not seem to have an appetite at all to pick that up because we heard in one of the media availabilities that there were a few senators who had real issue with the facts of what Speaker Schultz was acting on.
Sean Higgins, he's a politics reporter here at KUER, along with the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke and Holly Richardson. She's the editor for Utah Policy. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing this year's legislative session, which ended late last week. We have with us Sean Higgins, Robert Gerke, and Holly Richardson. Let's talk about the lake. Senate President Stuart Adams said few weeks ago now that lawmakers have spent more time discussing and analyzing the Great Salt Lake than any other issue in recent years.
I can't speak to how much time they spent studying the lake, I guess. There have been some things that have been done on the lake that are pretty groundbreaking. I mean, they spent, I think, $30 million to buy MagCor out of bankruptcy, and that's going to return water to the lake. That's huge, frankly. Mm-hmm. There was a resolution at the end to resolve this dispute with the federal government over some of the land on the northern end of the lake. So basically turning over about 22,000 acres to the federal government to be put into a bird refuge, which I think, but the fundamental fact of the matter remains that given the snowpack that we've had this year, we're probably going to reach a new low for the lake. Yeah. And that means that despite all the time they've spent studying it and all the steps that they've tried to take to address it, we're moving in the wrong direction. And I think they've kind of plucked the low-hanging fruit, and now the things that they need to get serious about is the ag water.
Hmm. Let's talk about homelessness. The governor said he said that it was the landmark session when it comes to homelessness.
I think it goes directly to the budget.
Because he got what he wanted.
He got what he wanted, $25 million in one-time funds and almost $20 million in ongoing funding, which I know the ongoing piece had been something people had been really skeptical, legislators had been very skeptical of in the past. Some of this was colored by this 1,300-bed campus, homeless campus, that was a big push by the governor starting last year and into this session. It doesn't sound like we are going to be getting a homeless campus tomorrow, but maybe laying the groundwork for something like this and also signaling for federal funds as well. I think that's a big question mark. And I think the other piece of this is, as of I believe today, we have a new state homeless coordinator in Tyler Clancy, mm-hmm. and it I think says something to either it's a vote of confidence in him or not putting him in an impossible spot where we say, hey, solve this huge state problem and there's no money for you to do it.
Can you just sort of clarify about what lawmakers did or didn't do about this homelessness, this campus?
I think a lot of it is just kind of signaling and doing a lot of the groundwork.
Too soon.
Too soon to really say. Like I think we might get something that looks like what this proposal is. I think Governor Cox said on the last night of the session, if like I'd love to not build it if we don't have to. Hmm. And I think it goes to this treatment first versus housing first debate a lot of people are having, where the Trump administration is very clearly a treatment first administration when it comes to homelessness. And we had been on the housing first side for a very long time.
Where's Clancy?
I think he comes at it from a very practical perspective, given his day job before then was being a cop and interacting with a lot of these parts of society on a day-to-day basis. And I don't see him as someone who is very like brittle and rigid in this treatment or housing space. I think he's probably more treatment than housing, but that's where I'm seeing it.
What happened with housing up at the legislature?
A lot of things that could bear fruit later, I think. I'm looking at things that didn't go anywhere. Representative Ray Ward had a bill that would have made it easier to build homes on smaller lots statewide. Talking with some experts in the housing space at the University of Utah, they show pictures of like historic neighborhoods in the Salt Lake Valley. You cannot physically build a house like that anymore because the zoning rules don't allow it. So like a lot of the houses you see in like Liberty Wells in Salt Lake City, you can't legally build a house like that anymore. It needs to be bigger on a bigger lot. This bill would have made it easier to build smaller homes on smaller lots, streamline that process, get shovels and dirt easier. That died a fiery death in committee after Representative Ward made all of these changes to appease a bunch of stakeholders, and it just got demolished and didn't make it out of committee. The other thing that I was following that I think could make a difference, this was HB 492 by Representative Calvin Roberts. It would make it easier for cities and towns to borrow money from the state at a lower cost to pay for big infrastructure projects. So there's a lot of lots in Utah that are zoned for housing, but there's no sewer, there's no electricity, there's no water out there. And that's a huge financial burden for a municipality to bring all those things in and then build housing on top. It can be really expensive. That could make those houses a lot more expensive than if those infrastructure bits were already there. So years down the road, this is something we could see some fruit born out of. But lawmakers say it could really help new homes get built faster and cheaper, but this isn't an immediate change. I don't think. I think the quote I heard was no municipality wants to pony up for like a $40 million water tank, and this will just make it that much easier of a pill to swallow.
So they're just talking about things right now. Still, they're not actually not much was actually done?
I think – well, I mean this bill did pass. So there is now a framework in place to for name your small town to get a low-cost loan from the state to build new sewer lines out to these lots that they could theoretically build housing on if they found a developer to do it.
Well, we're running out of time. I just – this is interesting. I wanted to mention the Representative Doug Fiafia. Was hoping to shield Utah kids from these dangers of these AI chatbots. He introduced a bill that would have required these big artificial intelligence companies to disclose, you know, how their systems would protect kids and public safety, those kinds of things. The White House got word of it, sent a memo opposing it, and I guess it killed it.
I understand there were multiple phone calls as well. You know, that was one of the issues that was really interesting to me from an outside.
Well, wait, sorry, before you go on, why they were saying this is the Fed's purview? So we don't want states dealing with making these decisions.
Well, that was one of the things that they had said, right? So when the One Big Beautiful Bill passed in the summer, Utah congressional representatives had been able and others had helped take that piece out of the One Big Beautiful Bill where the feds would be the only one to control AI regulation. And they're saying, no, we've got it in the state, right? We want to do it. And then we have by executive order, then the president said the federal government is going to be in charge of all AI regulations. And one of the things that's just, it's so weird to me, I guess, that Utah has led the way, in my opinion, in saying we're going to put guardrails on social media companies. We're going to put, you know, we're going to keep our kids protected. We're going to do all these things. And now that we're looking at AI, and I think Doug Fiafia comes with a tech background. I think he worked for one of the great big tech companies. I think it was Microsoft. And he's like, look, I've been working this bill. We've talked to people. We've surveyed people. 90% of the people that we've surveyed want these type of guardrails. And the White House is like, nope.
Let me give you a chance for a final word, all of you. So I think it was a record 1,000 pieces of legislation introduced early on. They passed 540 of them. It was an admin year, Sean, as you said. So they got stuff done. It was the final assessment. They could have been worse, I've heard, from some people's perspective. But it was workperson-like. What do you – final assessment. Sean Higgins, you first.
I would say it was a polite day at the office in many ways. I think one thing that stuck with me, this was like probably midway through the session where Speaker Schultz was saying how the House is really trying to be more thoughtful and deliberative with a lot of these bills. And we talked about how there was no appetite for clickbait. A lot of those bills just didn't make it out of House rules. They just sat there. And I think it shows in that I think the record number of bills introduced was probably a product of an election year to show your constituents, hey, I'm fighting for XYZ issue. Look at all these bills I introduced. And this looming specter of affordability coloring everything spoke to, one, the overall vibes, and two, this reduced number of about half of the bills that were introduced actually getting passed. So I think those were my two takeaways was everyone was pretty polite this year.
Holly?
I thought there were some good family policy bills that were passed. Representative DeFay was able to pass a bill that expands maternity leave for state employees. I think that's great. Expanded child tax credit. There were several bills like that. I'll just say the one that kind of brings a smile to my face is also DeFay's bill that says you do not need to signal upon leaving a roundabout. It was the law. Now it will no longer be the law.
Yeah, I think it was 500 little things and a couple big ones. You know, I think the judicial reform is going to have a profound impact on the way the courts administer or do their work. You know, there was a ban on kratom, they call it gas station
heroin.
Gas station heroin, getting that out of gas stations. the online porn tax credit, things like that, that are going to, like, you know, little things here and there.
Capital punishment.
Expediting the capital punishment proceedings that Candace Perucci, the expansion of the prison, which is going to be needed because they keep imposing harsher penalties for all of these different crimes.
Raw milk.
Yeah. With, we could go all day. But it's like 100 little things. And that's kind of how this whole session felt. It's like, you know, we're chasing these little things around and trying to keep track of all of them. But there wasn't sort of the overarching gigantic, you know, behemoth that kind of overwhelmed everything else. So it was like, you know, playing whack-a-mole, and we just the moles were smaller this time.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Robert Gerke, he's a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Holly Richardson joined us. She's a columnist for the Deseret News and the editor of Utah Policy. She's also the co-host of the KSL radio program called Inside Sources. And we had KUER's own politics reporter, Sean Higgins. He's co-host of the podcast State Street. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.